Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today, I'll be speaking with Michael Stamm, a historian at Michigan State University, and we'll be discussing his 2018 book called Dead Tree Media, Manufacturing the Newspaper in 20th Century North America. Dead Tree Media starts out with a really simple but weirdly thought-provoking premise that a newspaper used to be almost exclusively a physical object made out of paper. And so this meant the production of the newspaper required industrial production, mills, a distribution system to get physical copies to individual consumers, and of course, wood. It meant a lot of wood. It meant chopping down trees, acquiring forests, and managing international supply chains. And so this premise opens up an entire world that may seem distant from us today as we consume almost all of our news on screens. And so, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Dexter.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that we're getting a chance to talk about this book. It was one of the most creative and compelling media histories that I've ever read.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And so, firstly, can you just share with listeners what drove you to research this topic in the first place?
Sure. Yeah. I've been a media historian for my entire career as a graduate student and a professor. So this is about 20 years now. And I had started out, I've always tried to combine political economy and cultural history. So I've looked at essentially how what the evolving rules of the game were for communications media, and then tried to figure out what that meant for creating the informational environments that people live in. And I had done a lot of my early work on radio history and found myself kind of working back to the moment when radio was developing as a new medium. And I got kind of fascinated by the fact that there were all these newspapers that were getting involved in early radio, and that what people had been calling, you know, this kind of media revolution looked a lot less like that than it did a kind of co-optation of a new form of communications media by the old dominant communications media. So I ended up writing my first book about that, about the newspaper ownership of radio from about 1920 to about 1950. And I got really interested as I was finishing up that book in two things. And one of them was how this thing, the newspaper that everybody was predicting was just going to wither away because of radio and then later because of television, not only didn't wither away, but got even more powerful and profitable and more important. Newspapers were the most, they generated more advertising revenue than any other medium into the mid-1990s. Even when the news cycle went 24 hours in the 1980s, newspapers were still the most important drivers of that news cycle. And so I kind of wanted to know, you know, what was it that kept them around for this long when everybody was just predicting their demise? And then the other thing that got me into this specific project was, as I was researching how publishers did their business, I kept coming across in publishers' archives and in the trade journals in the US, all of these references to these Canadian newsprint suppliers that seem to be just giving these Americans fits. And you know, to the point that I used to like jokingly think of them as like, they were like the Libyans that Christopher Lloyd would talk about in Back to the Future, that they just became like these like boogeymen. And I what on earth, like, why are, like, what does Canadian newsprint have to do with printing an American newspaper? And that was just sort of where I started. And I started digging around, and before too long, I sort of realized that they'd had just about everything to do with it. That, you know, by the middle of the 20th century, about 80% of the newsprint that was used in the United States had started as a tree in Canada. And so just kind of following that thread and trying to figure out and explain how that happened was basically what generated the book.
Yeah, the book is doing a lot. I mean, it starts off with this like broader history of the rise of the industrial newspaper, the significance of you know, wood supplies, and then it kind of zooms in on a biography of the Robert McCormick-led Chicago Tribune, and then kind of takes a step back and looks at the broader history of the newspaper in the second half of the 20th century. And so given how richly just wide-ranging the book is, I think it would be really useful to maybe just start off with what you see as the major intervention that it's making.
I guess there's a couple of them. You know, one of them is this idea that information is material. And it remains that way. You know, back when newspapers were the dominant form of media, it was all material. You gave someone money in exchange for a collated sheet of paper that had news and advertisements on it. That history is something that people seem to be under the impression that we've kind of moved into this era of kind of dematerialized media. Which I don't think is true at all. It's just that the factories have moved and the devices that people are using to access media have changed, but it's still very much the same. And I think you can draw a straight line from, you know, the lithium and rare earth metals that are in your iPhone that's manufactured in China, despite being designed in California, as Apple announces to you on the back of the device. I think you can draw a straight line back to these kind of international resource-driven supply chains that were part of the history of the daily newspaper, that, you know, that it was Canadian trees rather than Chilean lithium. And it was US newspapers as opposed to this digital device. But the history of information is a material history, and it really fits in with and is an important part of these emerging histories of industrial capitalism. So I think that's one of the big interventions there, is that we have to consider the history of media as part of a history of industrial capitalism. I think one of the things that I also hope that the book does is kind of remind people that there's a tendency, I think, sometimes to use journalism and newspapers interchangeably, and that's not the case. Journalism is a hugely important part of what's in a newspaper. I mean, for historians, you know, that's often how we find out about the past. This is, you go to the newspaper to find evidence of what happened. And, you know, in the age where you can get a lot of these things through targeted keyword searches digitally, what's delivered to you are these little gems of the articles themselves. Everything's without context. You just get the article from the 1948 edition of the New York Times. But if you kind of step back and look at the newspaper as a whole thing, you can see that there were these, you know, these giant packages of news, even on weekday. I mean, Sunday newspapers are a whole other thing. I mean, these things weighed, you know, a pound and a half. But a daily newspaper is this massive and visually rich document that has journalism in it. It has, you know, all sorts of other advice columns, classified ads. There's been a brilliant book recently by Julia Guarneri about this, like all this diverse content. And all of this, it's this big package of paper that you get every day. And it's, you know, as a material history, as a material object and as a part of industrial capitalism, it's this huge achievement. I mean, these publishers in big cities would print a million copies of a manufactured item on Monday morning, have it all sold by late morning on Monday, and then do the whole thing again on Tuesday. And so I really wanted to kind of reorient people back to the idea that newspapers were these big objects made out of paper. that people would get on a daily basis that would have, you know, in addition to the journalism, all sorts of other things that would tell them, that would let them know about what was going on in the world around them. So getting them to think about the old paper package of the delivery. I guess also there were two other things I guess that I really wanted to do in the book, and one of these was to show that this was another instance, the way that that U.S. newspapers were able to operate had to do with government subsidies. We often think of newspapers as, I think in terms of in First Amendment terms, and we think of editors and journalists who are you know speaking truth to power, and many of them and there are many important instances of people doing that. But as business enterprises, newspapers have been and remain to be heavily subsidized. I mean, Richard John's work on the post office was sort of pioneering in showing how the post office enabled the circulation of information. And what I found was that tariff policy did this, essentially by allowing Canadian newsprint to come to the United States with no duties on it. The U.S. government gave a multi-year, multi-billion dollar subsidy to newspapers. And what they did with this newsprint was they printed journalism, but they also printed all of the advertising that generated the overwhelming majority of the revenues that kept the businesses going. And then the last thing was I really hope that the book shows American readers how intertwined US and Canadian history are. That's not a big insight for Canadians, but for Americans, it does remain that. I mean, there's been an increasing call among Americanists in the last couple decades to internationalize American history, to globalize American history, and there's been a lot of amazing work that's been done there. But it has struck me that there's been this strange absence of the country that is immediately to the north of the United States, and with which the United States has had one of the most robust trade relationships in the world, and it for some reason it just really hasn't shown up in the historiography as much as it should. And so part of the book's project was to make a case to American readers that they needed to think more broadly and deeply about Canadian history and about North American history. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, just to that last point, you know, as a Canadian who has spent a lot of time in the United States, it's always been, you know, both like puzzling and entertaining just to see how little people actually know about Canada.
Yes.
So I'm glad that you're doing that work. But yeah, no, that's a really wonderful sort of overview of the book. And maybe a first topic to discuss, or that'd be interesting to discuss, would be how American publishers became dependent on Canadian resources, in particular, what that dependence looked like, sort of like in a material way, but then also what that dependence felt like for Americans.
Right. So it happened until the middle of the 19th century, the cotton rags were the major source for the manufacturing of paper. And a German inventor in the 1870s invented a way to make cheap paper that could withstand the rigors of industrial printing out of wood pulp. And this just dramatically expanded the base of raw materials that would be available to make paper. And at the time, the materials that was best suited to do this were trees that were located in the global north. So these were things, you know, in particular spruce trees. And so you find what begins to develop around the world, around the globe, is in these northern climates, Canada, and then especially across the Atlantic and Scandinavia, is the development of a wood pulp based newspaper industry. So there had been a little bit of this happening in the United States, or more than a little bit happening in northern states, Maine, Minnesota, Massachusetts, New York. But before the era of the rise of the conservation movement, so that is to say, you know, before Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot begin to make this something that the federal government makes, you know, a very important policy consideration, there had been a lot of cutting around mills done relatively indiscriminately. And people, there were these congressional hearings in the late 19th and early 20th century where there's people who are saying that you know, there's a near-term horizon for the exhaustion of the kinds of forest resources that Americans are going to need to continue to produce newspapers. And so people started trying to figure out, you know, what a solution was. Well, one of the things that they stumbled upon as being an obvious one was just, well, there's a whole lot of trees just north of the US-Canada border. Why can't we go get access to those? And that took a series of complicated policy negotiations in the early 20th century. The Canadians played it pretty smart, and they said, you know, we have the trees that you want. And so we're going to have it. We're going to exercise the bargaining power that we have in this relationship. And we're willing to talk about a trade agreement in which you can take a manufactured good across the border, but we're not just going to let you cut down the trees and take those. If you're going to do that, you're going to pay duties. Or there were even cases where there were embargoes on pulpwood exports to the United States. So starting around 1911, the U.S. and Canada entered into these negotiations about trade reciprocity. And there were a number of goods that were up for debate, a number of agricultural commodities, not much in the way of manufactured goods, but the one that was really important in those negotiations was newsprint. This was something that newspaper publishers really wanted, and they spent a lot of time and energy leaning on members of Congress to make sure that this went through. And so this goes through fine in the United States, and it goes to Canada for parliamentary approval, and it hits a snag, and Wilfrid Laurier calls an election, and it's a single issue election. The issue is basically, is Canada going to enter into this free trade agreement with the United States or not? And Laurier loses the election. This is the end of Laurier's Liberals lose the election. This is the end of their long rule. And the reciprocity agreement is scuttled, but one thing is made duty free as a result of a loophole enacted in the laws, and that was newsprint. And so U.S. publishers then have access. If the way that the mechanics of the negotiation were pretty simple, if a U.S. manufacturer went to Canada and built a mill there and did everything there up to the point of manufacturing the newsprint, that manufacturer could send that newsprint to the United States without paying a penny of duties. So it's basically an integrated free trade continental market for what newspapers needed to exist. And before long, took about a decade for the industry to really shift up north. It's a capital intensive industry, newsprint manufacturing, and so people had to go up there and build the mills. But by the post World War I period, that had clearly happened. That Canada had become the dominant source of American newspapers. And to your last question, there's these kind of richly ironic belly achings in U.S. newspaper trade journals, because they realize, having gotten exactly what they wanted, they had essentially lost control of the newsprint that they depended on. And now this thing that had been based on resources that they were getting in their own country was now something that was on the other side of an international border and subject to the whims and policies of policymakers that they had a lot less influence over. And so there was a tremendous amount of anxiety about publishers in the 20s. And this would peak up at different points as the 20th century went along. Nobody in the U.S. really minded as long as the prices stayed relatively low. But whenever the prices would spike up, all of a sudden publishers would sort of get newly nationalistic about taking back control of newsprint supplies. And you see this quite a bit right after World War II. There's a big push among a lot of people in the U.S. to kind of renationalize American production so that American newspapers, weren't threatened by the whims of these Canadians who controlled all the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that stuff so interesting. There were congressional hearings in 1950.
Yeah.
And you quote the general manager of the LA Daily News, who said, you know, how can we expect to have a healthy free press unless we have an adequate domestic source of raw material for this vital industry?
Yep.
And so you can really sense like the anxiety about having to go abroad for resources.
The U.S. as an empire had just gotten so used to doing these things on their terms, and often without negotiations, you know, going back to the period after the Spanish-American War, and the dealings with Canada always were under the, they were, they, it was always something that it had to be negotiated. And that I think a lot of, a lot of American policymakers found that very frustrating because that was not what they were used to having to do in the Western Hemisphere. They were used to just getting the raw materials that they wanted and needed on the terms that they demanded.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually.
When you compare it with sugar in the Caribbean, you know, most other resources in the Western Hemisphere, military incursion would be the precursor to a market being set up that would supply the United States. And, you know, I found that, and there's a little bit in the book, there were a handful of these American congressional representatives who made these sort of outlandish statements in Congress about how they thought we should just annex Canada. And if we just went ahead and did that, we wouldn't have to worry about that. And that provoked some not insignificant consternation among Canadians who used this in the 1911 election campaign as a rallying cry to get people to vote for the Conservatives, saying, you know, if you don't do this, there's a decent chance that Canada might be annexed by the Americans, who would simply do that because they want our natural resources. Like, look what they're doing throughout the rest of the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking back to this paper that I wrote in high school, which was literally about sort of the possibility of Americans taking over our water supplies.
Yeah.
So yeah, these anxieties continue. And so just moving on, the sort of like the center of your book is the Robert McCormick led Chicago Tribune. Yep. And this is really interesting for ideological reasons, probably above all. Maybe before we get into like some of the arguments about, or at least like in this middle part of your book, can you just give listeners a profile of who Robert McCormick was and what the Chicago Tribune was?
Mm-hmm. Sure. McCormick is a sort of endlessly fascinating figure, I think. He was a native Midwesterner who was very proud of that. He was born into a family of privilege. His grandfather had started the paper, or bought a stake of the Tribune, and it was sort of the family business. He was brought up with an incredible amount of privilege, and he came to take over the Tribune in 1911. He had had a career as an alderman in Chicago and had been a head of the Chicago Sanitary District, and he looked like he might be headed for a career in politics. As had one of his brothers, but he ended up getting turned out of office, and he had the family business to fall back on. And so when it came time to take over, he took over the paper with his cousin Joseph Patterson in 1911, and this was right about the time that the Free Trade Agreement was going. But McCormick was a very conservative man. He disliked and detested and resented East Coast elites. He had this lifelong antipathy towards Franklin Roosevelt that seems to date back to some overlap that they had in prep school. Although as far as I know, no one has turned up a smoking gun for what really started this all, but he had this incredible hatred for Franklin Roosevelt. But he hated East Coast elites. He really didn't like much about Britain. He was an America First guy, back when that was, you know, when that was a thing within the, you know, in the Lindbergh era as well. And he ran the paper that way. It was a paper that I think is a really fascinating newspaper, because as a newspaper, it really doesn't fit well at all with the traditional histories of the newspaper business and of journalism that are kind of the mainstream ways that we understand newspapers. That is, that there was a partisan period in the 18th century, and in the 19th century, this gives way to the penny press, and you begin to see the mass press detach itself from party loyalty. So, you know, you no longer see fewer and fewer papers with the names of the party in the paper, the Springfield Democrat or the Springfield Republican, for example. And then in the 20th century, you get the rise of the professional reporter and the development of codes of objectivity, and you have these newspapers that are giving objective, fact-based news to the masses. And there's almost nothing about McCormick's Tribune that fits that. I mean, it was an outrageously and overtly conservative outlet for the entire time that he ran it, until he died in 1955. But what's really important about it is not just that it had those politics, but that he used the Tribune to then found the New York Daily News, which was one of the first tabloid newspapers in the United States. His cousin Joe Patterson went and ran that, and they started that in 1919. And by the 1930s, they had these were the two highest circulating newspapers in the United States. And the Daily News was a picture-based tabloid that trafficked in sensationalism and these really jarring images. And so I sort of find McCormick and that company really fascinating, because what he created were not marginal newspapers. His company had the highest circulating newspaper in the U.S. in the New York Daily News, and then the Tribune was the highest circulating broadsheet newspaper in the United States. And yet, you almost never see sustained consideration of this in journalism history. There's a lot of times I think that what a lot of us have done in writing journalism history is focus on the people in the news organizations that we admire, and focus less attention on the news organizations that a lot of Americans relied upon to give them the news. And so I find the Tribune Company really fascinating on those grounds. But McCormick created this hugely successful newspaper. He developed one of the first really major multimedia conglomerates in the United States. He did things that I think William Randolph Hearst is often talked about as like the only person who did this. But when you look at the media empire that McCormick created in the Midwest, he bought in to radio very early. The Tribune was called the world's greatest newspaper. He was not a very modest man. And the call letters of the broadcasting station that he started were WGN, which was the acronym for World's Greatest Newspaper. So he got into radio. He started doing making newsreels. He later got in WGN Television, was later one of the first television stations in the city, along with the Turner Broadcasting System. It was later, this is long after McCormick's death, one of the first satellite stations. And he had this vision of the Tribune as not just being a paper that was going to serve the city of Chicago, but that was going to serve this region that he coined a term for, the Chicagoland region. And he was going to develop this infrastructure that was going to allow him to gather news and send printed newspapers out to communities all across Illinois, Iowa, Michigan, Indiana. So there were, you know, it was this idea of creating a really this regional colossus out of a newspaper. And so he created this extraordinarily successful newspaper that was trafficking in, you know, a very reactionary brand of politics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's a great summation of who he was and what his newspaper was trying to do. But it's even more interesting when you start considering these like international connections. So, you know, in spite of his, you know, his like America Firstism, his hyper-nationalism, he also pursued this like really innovative international solution to the paper supply problem. You know, he essentially bypassed the middleman selling newsprint, and you know, his company bought Canadian timberlands, built their own mills, and then manufactured their own paper. Can you share this story?
Yeah, that was the sort of the really eye-opening stuff for me. I was just so fortunate to stumble upon this trove of documents that allowed me to do that. There was, when I started just doing searches for archives, I knew the Tribune archives in Chicago, and I started going into archival search engines and just putting terms in. And I it it I found this collection that had been processed but not made public at Library and Archives Canada in Ottawa. And I got in touch with an archivist named Stephen Salmon, who was just this extraordinary guy who was, you know, man, and an archivist who just was, I couldn't have done this without the work that he did. And he basically had gotten the corporate archive of the Tribune's Canadian subsidiary, and just, it was 500 and some odd boxes of material and tens of thousands of photographs and technical drawings. And the collection wasn't open to researchers when I started working with it. And the last time I checked a couple of years ago, I think it's still closed, but it's this amazing collection. But what it details in there is how the Tribune Company built this multinational vertically integrated supply chain that allowed it to control everything about the production of a newspaper, starting with the trees in Canada that were growing in forests. It had just these massive forest concessions. I mean, you know, like the size of like the American state of Connecticut, you know, these really, I mean, by Canadian standards, those aren't huge, I guess, but, you know, by American standards, you know, having a forest concession the size of an entire state is something. And, you know, they built a fleet of boats, and they would, you know, they built two newsprint mills. They built one in Thorold, Ontario. And then they built one. They built a newsprint mill in the entire town of Baie-Comeau, Quebec, in the 1930s. But you know, you had this guy who was you know, this proudly nationalist American who was also at the same time very proud of the fact that he had created this company that was operating across the U.S.-Canada border as a multinational manufacturing firm. And I think in doing this, He looked at himself in a lot of ways, McCormick did, as a peer and as a rival of Henry Ford, and he and an industrialist like Ford. I mean, he wanted to be considered somebody that Americans would talk about in that breath. And so he looked at this at publishing a newspaper and making an industrial newspaper chain supply chain. He looked at that as a way of demonstrating, you know, his capabilities at doing this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would love for you to talk a little bit more about his critique of the New Deal, yeah. You know, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and especially the town of Norris, Tennessee, which was, more or less a company town for people that were working one of the dams in the TVA. And that sort of with his own company town in Quebec.
Yeah, yeah, that was probably the most, that was really the most fascinating part of this in a lot of ways, is that he was rabidly anti-New Deal. I mean, it just like pathological, almost pathological. He hated Roosevelt, he hated the New Deal, and he hated everything they were doing. And on a daily basis would in the news columns of his paper and in the editorials just attack everything that the New Deal was doing as being some sort of, you know, everything was some sort of Leninist or Stalinist project. And he really, really hated the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was this effort by the New Deal to do major hydroelectric developments along the Tennessee River and provide, among other things, electrification for a region that didn't have it. So this was going to promote industrial development, and it was also going to promote the electrification of homes in rural areas where there were still people who were living these lives that were basically not that different from the ones that their grandparents had lived. And McCormick just thought that this was some sort of Leninist project. And he hated the fact that the federal government was doing these massive public hydroelectric projects. And he really hated that they had built this town, Norris, Tennessee, which was this kind of model company town that these new dealers had built to house the workers who were building the dam. And they looked at this. This is Arthur Morgan and Earl Draper. They looked at this as this idea that they could make portable and they could do in other parts of the country. That is, you know, you could use good planning principles and to build these towns that fit in next to industrial developments that were going to be financed by the federal government. And you could use the built environment to give people good and enriching lives. And you know, the Tennessee, you know, there were a lot of Americans who looked at the ordinary and academics who looked at the Tennessee Valley Authority and thought that this was going to be this great model that could be used in other parts of the country. And McCormick just thought that it was just absolutely outrageous. And this was one of the most obvious signs to him in the mid 30s that we were headed towards something that was going to look like Soviet Russia. And it, the one of the most ironic, or, you know, maybe even hypocritical things is that at the same time that he's making all these statements in his newspaper about the Tennessee Valley Authority, he's doing almost exactly the same thing on the other side of an international border in Quebec. Which is to say he gets a large land concession that's given to him by the state, by the Quebec government. And the land concession allows him to cut down trees, and it allows him to develop hydroelectric power on the rivers up there. There's at the time that where the town where Baie-Comeau is now, if you look at it on a map now, there's not a ton up there right now, even. I mean, it's 450 some miles northeast of Montreal. At the time that McCormick went up there in the mid 1930s, there was really next to nothing up there in terms of industrial development. There was an indigenous population, but there was very little industrial development up there. So he gets this concession from the Quebec government, and then he also has in his pocket the fact that American tariff policy has made it such that he can build a branch plant up in Canada and get the newsprint to his Chicago and New York printing plants without paying a penny of duties to anybody. And so he's got state policy in two countries that benefit him. And he decides that what he's going to do is he not just build a mill and let private development happen around it, but he's going to build a company. He's going to build this model town. He's going to show the world that he can do exactly what the New Deal was doing with the TVA in Tennessee, but that this was something he could do as somebody in the private sector. And you can see it's in a lot of ways a sort of high, like a kind of corporate variant of high modernist social planning. It's done by the private sector. I learned a lot from Greg Grandin's book about Henry Ford's escapades in Brazil. And McCormick, I think McCormick looked at Fordlandia as a kind of model. And I think McCormick relished the fact that he was successful. I mean, you know, Fordlandia is this sort of spectacular failure, as Grandin narrates it. And Baie-Comeau was, for the Tribune Company, this huge success. And it's still there. There's still a newsprint mill there. There's other industry there. It's still a quaint little town along the river, and it's very beautiful, especially in the springtime. But this was all he did all of this development in Canada while promoting America First ideas in the United States and railing against the sorts of federal developments like the TVA was doing. And he was doing all of this with the support of two nations policies mm-hmm. in Canada.
Yeah. I mean, what I really liked about this section was that you were also using sort of like Chicago Tribune articles about Baie-Comeau.
Yeah.
You know, so like the Tribune was like really advertising this like variant of modernization that was basically run by the private sector with the not talked about help of both governments. You know, you have this anecdote about you know, the first wedding in Baie-Comeau in 1937. You see this, you know, like metropolitan newspaper in Chicago that was doing stories about its own company town.
Yeah, they would. I think the two aims there were, I mean, he wanted to show, the paper wanted to show, they wanted to demonstrate the reach and scope and potency of the corporation, you know, to show that, you know, this, even though the paper was in Chicago, this Midwestern city that was, you know, always feeling, you know, like second to New York, that it had this command of resources and space that stretched all the way up, you know, well north into Canada. And they would run these articles periodically about the first ships in the spring that would deliver newsprint to Chicago after the Great Lakes became navigable again after they thawed. And so there was this desire to kind of show that the company was this very powerful industrial enterprise. He didn't want to hide the fact that his company was an industrial enterprise. He wanted people to recognize that. And I think in a lot of ways, he also wanted to use these articles about the people of Baie-Comeau and to show that he wanted to demonstrate that he was good at being paternalist. He had this vision, I think, that was, you know, he was living in Chicago when the town of Pullman failed spectacularly. And he did share a lot of George Pullman's vision about, you know, you know, not only building a town as he did in Baie-Comeau, but also being somebody who was kind of a shepherd for Chicago. I mean, he was an unabashed elitist who thought that people should listen to him and just follow his orders and believe what he suggested that they believe. And so by printing these articles about his workforce in Canada, I think he was able to kind of demonstrate that he was very good at taking care of people, that he was really good at being paternalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just moving on to the 1940s, this is a really interesting moment. Again, you have these sort of necessities of like the everyday operation of the business, sort of in conflict with the ideological arguments of Robert McCormick. McCormick was extremely critical of Great Britain. And then once the Second World War started and, Britain and Canada, entered the war, he was, while still using paper from Canada, using trees, chopping down trees and turning them into newsprint and then shipping them down to the United States, he was basically attacking the war effort of Canada. And so this is another weird irony of all of this. Can you maybe talk a little bit about this, about how the Second World War played out for the Chicago Tribune?
Yeah, they got in a lot of hot water over this. The Canadians were rightly outraged about this, that you had, they had gone into the war, they were in World War II for more than 2 years before the United States was. And McCormick's paper was, it was an America First isolationist newspaper. I mean, he had no interest whatsoever he was actively opposed to the idea of the United States entering the war. And again, he's a very selective internationalist. He's perfectly happy to, talk about how good of a steward he was for the people who lived in his Canadian company town. But when it came to the idea of people in Canada going to, people in the United States going to war alongside people in Canada against fascism, that was a line he wasn't willing to cross. And so he kept printing this newspaper that was incredibly isolationist, very anti-British, in many respects pro-German. And this got him on the radar of a lot of Canadians who were rightly outraged and who were fully aware of what was going on here. The Tribune was operating, what was a major industrial enterprise in Canada. And this reaches the Canadian Parliament, where you have people standing up and saying, how on earth is it that we can allow this American publisher the privilege to cut down our trees and make newsprint and take it down and then print articles against the war effort that Canadians are currently engaged in. And so there were these efforts, there were these discussions about what to do with it. I mean, should the Tribune be banned? Should their enterprises be shut down? That ultimately didn't happen to them. The controversy didn't ultimately manifest in any significant actions against the Tribune. The most that they suffered was there were power regulations that went into place in Ontario in order to allow plants that were making munitions and things that were necessary for the war effort more power to do that. And so his paper mill in Ontario was forced to run at a lower power output than it had been previously. And so the output went down for a couple of years. And there were these articles, there were a few articles that the Tribune published suggesting that this was somehow some sort of, some sort of hit job on the part of Canadian policymakers that were trying to get back at the Tribune for the articles that he was publishing. But the operation ultimately survived. He didn't suffer any significant financial damage as a result of it. But it did bring his enterprise to the attention of a lot of Canadians who maybe weren't quite aware of the scope of the operation. It was, I think, a pretty widespread phenomenon in Eastern Canada at that time, in Ontario, especially in Ontario, where pro-British sentiments ran stronger than they did in Quebec. It was pretty widely known what he was doing and what the politics of his newsprint manufacturing were. His reputation took a hit in Ontario as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the 1940s are also interesting because this is the moment that the Tribune Company really diversifies. You have just some lovely evidence from this luncheon in New York in the immediate post-war years, I think like 1947, in which the company was showing off some of its new products. And so can you share with listeners what some of those products were, and maybe explain what the factors were, what some of the factors were that pushed a newspaper company towards producing things that had nothing to do with the news?
Sure. Yeah. So there was a lot of waste in the newsprint manufacturing business. It required a lot of water inputs. So you put a lot of clean water in and a lot of dirty water came out. There were a lot of chemicals involved in the manufacturing of the pulp and then the manufacturing of the paper. And during the war, the Tribune Company started, materials for all sorts of industrial production were running in short supply. And the company began employing a staff of chemists. They put a staff of chemists to work to try and figure out ways of making the production process more efficient. So figuring out ways of recycling and repurposing certain aspects of the industrial production. And one of these things they figured out that they could use some of the waste sulfite liquor as a way of contributing to the manufacture of synthetic rubber. And so at one point they made these tires, car tires out of a compound that they were calling Tribuna. And they put them on a car and they sent it on this well-publicized journey, drive from Chicago to Los Angeles. And the idea was that the Tribune was going to help contribute to these American rubber shortages that had been developed because Southeast Asian supplies had been cut off during the war. But then they also started fiddling around with some of these other chemicals that were, and some of these byproducts that had been developing during the newsprint manufacturing process. And they made a few pretty interesting advances there. And the one that they figured out ways that you could make paper plates, for example, out of some of the bark that had been, when you debark the logs that you were going to use to manufacture the paper, you were left with cellulose material that wasn't fit to make newsprint, but you could make other forms of paper. And one of them, so they made for this luncheon, they made these paper plates out of used paper stock to do that. But then they also figured out that you could make a chemical called vanillin, which they derived from lignin, which was a chemical agent it was a hydrocarbon that was a part of the tree that wasn't useful for the manufacture of paper. And chemists and chemical engineers have been kind of puzzling around and experimenting with lignin for a while in the 20th century. And the Tribune was operating at a scale that they had a lot of it on their hands. And what they figured out was if you ran this lignin through a series of what seemed to be pretty flammable and toxic chemical processes, you would ultimately end up with a powder that you could use as synthetic vanilla flavoring. And they became they developed a side business in the manufacture of synthetic vanilla flavoring, and were selling that to food producers around the world for decades after World War II. But it was this fascinating story about how you have these products that were part of the newsprint manufacturing chain that ultimately had nothing to do with the newspaper, Using these chemical byproducts, you could make rubber, you could make synthetic vanilla flavoring. You could also there was experiments done. They sold another less refined version of vanillin to the Merck Corporation that began using it to make hypertension drugs. So it was part of this movement in the 30s and the 40s of people who were trying to figure out all of these things that could be done with the byproducts of agricultural production. These people there was a movement called Chemergy that had a kind of short lifespan at that time that were of people trying to do this. But that was this, it was this sort of fascinating element of this newspaper company becoming a manufacturer of synthetic vanilla flavoring.
Yeah, it's so strange. It's so strange, but it's also these are the consequences of, newsprint being an industrially manufactured product. Chemical agents that can get turned into alcohol or vanilla flavoring. It's super fascinating.
I think it's a really interesting story to me of just, I think it speaks to the degree to which McCormick was somebody who looked at this newspaper enterprise as an industrial enterprise. And the idea was like, how do you squeeze every bit of efficiency out of the production process? And how do you take things that have excess capacity and do something else with it? Like, I mean, I see a lot of industrial corporations doing this. I mean, you know, the meatpacking industry was one that newsprint manufacturers often looked at as like the model of an industry that wasted nothing. Like everything, like if that cow went in one end of the slaughterhouse, there was like everything got used somehow. And newsprint manufacturers like McCormick, like really looked at that as a model. Like we want to make sure that when that tree comes down, we extract every possible cent of value that we can out of that tree. Regardless of you know, and that ultimately ends up generating some products, some revenue streams that don't seem to have obvious connections to the primary one of printing news and advertising for American mm-hmm. readers.
Yeah, and maybe just moving on to I guess closer to the end of the book, problem of newsprint shortages just continues, and especially after the Second World War, it's a global problem. And you kind of track different attempts to deal with this issue. And so maybe instead of just giving us an overview, can you talk about one in particular that surprised me because I had never heard of it, facsimile broadcasting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was this kind of wild moment. So this happened in the 19... There were experiments with facsimile back to the 20s, I think. I recall reading articles going back that far. But the idea was that you would use the airwaves to, rather than sending out sound, you would send out information that would be decoded in the home by a device that would then produce that information on a piece of paper, just like a fax machine. I mean, it's the same technology that would later be used by fax machines that would use telephone wires. But they would be successful as point to point communications devices. But there was this thought that in the 30s and the 40s that you could use facsimile as a mass medium. And so the main motivating factor for publishers was that what it meant you could do is you could sell somebody a newspaper, but then you might not have to bear the cost of having this massive industrial plant and all this newsprint. You could essentially offload the cost of printing onto the user, who would have to maintain the set in the home and then buy the paper. And so McCormick, and he was one of a number of people in the broadcasting and publishing industries who did a lot of experiments with facsimile broadcasting. And the technology never, it was a little bit too far ahead of its time in terms of the ability of people to manufacture sets that worked well at the cost you could get them for. They ended up being these extraordinarily expensive sets that delivered these really what were just kind of cruddy printed newspapers. Like for what you would pay to have a facsimile set in your house and what you would pay for the paper, compared to the fact that you could go out and buy this massive piece of newsprint just down the block, or have this massive piece of newsprint just show up on your doorstep, you know, for pennies a day, it just never really took off. And most people found that for the kinds of news that they were getting over the fax, they were perfectly happy just getting that over the radio. But it was this really interesting moment where you see publishers begin to kind of push up against the limits of industrial paper and begin to try to find ways of perhaps freeing themselves from having to maintain these printing plants. And so with the facsimile technology, they thought they would do it over the airwaves, just like with broadcasting, and that would get spit out. And these episodes continued into the 1970s and the 1980s with television based newsprint delivery systems. The Dow Jones Company tried this, Knight Ridder tried this, and again, they never quite the technologies, they always seemed clunky and kind of awkward to people, and never really seemed to offer a kind of satisfying substitute for the newspaper. And they could never be done at cost and at scale. And so they failed. But it does show, I think, that there were these people like McCormick and dozens of other people who were trying, and corporations getting involved in facsimile broadcasting, who started trying to extend ways of delivering news that went beyond the printed page. And what they found, this essentially was what was realized with the internet in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the problem of paper becomes like a different kind of problem as we get to, you know, like a more like digitized age of information. Can you talk a little bit about, just like how that problem changes?
Yeah. That's sort of where I ended the book. And it was, you know, that for a newspaper publisher in before the latter part of the late, for a newspaper publisher until really recently, like we're talking like the last like 25 years, one of the biggest problems that the enterprise faced was getting adequate supplies of paper at a cost that allowed them to continue to do business profitably. And there were rarely moments of scarcities in the United States where the existence of newspapers was threatened. This was the case in post-World War II Europe, and there were instances where, you know, there were these attempts to get foreign newsprint to war-torn publishers who could then begin printing again. But American publishers, the big problem they faced there was that the cost of newsprint would fluctuate wildly. And in many newspapers ultimately would go out of business because the costs of printing simply were too great for them. So the problem of paper for a publisher was that you always had to have it on hand at a price that allowed you to continue to do business. And like a lot of things in the newspaper business, there was this favored people who could operate at scale. At people who were buying, the more newsprint you bought, the cheaper the price it was that you paid for it. And this went back to the late 19th and early 20th century. And this is one of the things that motivated McCormick to try and vertically integrate himself, is that he thought that if he vertically integrated the newsprint manufacturing, he would free himself up from having to buy paper at market prices that would fluctuate. And so he controlled the problem that way. But what began to happen in the really late 20th century and recently is that the problem of paper became for publishers that increasing numbers of consumers simply didn't want to buy paper. They got a lot more comfortable getting news on the radio, on television, and especially getting news on the screen, on the internet, because that was the thing that really finally broke the newspaper's monopoly on printed knowledge. I mean, the radio and television added a lot to the informational environment that people lived in, but these were different media and they had different conventions and they had different appeals. And there was a different way that one interacted with it. You can't, for example, skim through radio stories. And there's a lot of people who much preferred to read a newspaper, even in the broadcast era, because of the temporal control that it offered them and the selectivity that it offered them. But once you get to text on a screen with the internet, and by the way, in the early period, it's all free. I mean, this was this huge error that newspaper publishers made by just kind of throwing it all up there for free in the beginning. That seemed for a lot of people to be, especially younger people, to be an adequate substitute. And they no longer seemed to think that getting this collection of paper every day was something that they needed to do. And this is the thing that really ultimately has transformed the newspaper business. I try to propose in the book this idea that what people sometimes look at this as a crisis of journalism and a crisis of public intelligence. And, you know, there are days where it's hard to not see a crisis of public intelligence and it's hard not to see, you know, a crisis for journalists. But the thing that really hit newspapers hard was it's a business problem. And the business of printing a newspaper in the industrial era was based on the idea that you sold people a lot of paper at a very, very low price. I mean, newsprint, it's cheap paper. I mean, it's pulp. I mean, it's, you know, pulp fiction. It's printed on the cheapest paper that they could make that would withstand the rigors of industrial printing. And what they would put on that paper is a lot of advertising. I mean, that's one of the things you realize when you read a newspaper cover to cover, or you skim through a whole newspaper on ProQuest or on microfilm, is you realize that more than half of most successful newspapers it wasn't news, it was ads. And so the higher your circulation, the more you could charge for ads, and you could essentially not really worry that much about revenue from circulation, because you're really making a lot of these publishers were making the lion's share of their revenues from advertising. And as people buy newspapers as fewer people buy newspapers, the advertisers look at them as somewhat less attractive ad buys, and you begin to get this kind of vicious cycle downward. And this is what has sort of led us to this situation where you pick up a printed newspaper now, and they often seem just so thin and flimsy. And there's something, you know, especially about local newspapers, there's something really kind of sad and tragic about some of them. They you know, that if you're old enough to remember, you know, having a newspaper that had some heft to it, you pick up a daily edition of a newspaper in a mid-sized North American city, and it feels slight, and you read it, and it seems like a lot of what you're reading in it is stuff that you already heard about the night before or the day before online, or, you know, on the radio or saw on television. So that's sort of the problem of paper in the 21st century, is that fewer people want to buy printed newspapers, and fewer advertisers are putting ads in it, and newspapers have really struggled to figure out a way to generate revenue other than that advertising subsidy that had sustained them for the 20th century. I think, you know, the New York Times will often report quarterly how they're doing on revenue, and, you know, their digital revenues are now, I think, greater than the print revenues. You know, they rely on people who are paying for digital subscriptions. But they're an outlier, and they're a paper that draws on a readership that I think by and large treats it like they treat public radio, which is to say it's a public good that you're willing to support with a few bucks every month. But a lot of local newspapers are not really getting this kind of support from local readers, and it's just hemorrhaging. I mean, there's just this huge gap at the local level, that as these newspapers have declined and died, you find, you know, mid-sized communities all across North America that don't have a daily newspaper anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's, a useful, although sad, place to leave our discussion of the book. Yeah. I mean, it's
incredibly sad. Yeah.
It's just really hard to, like think about all the stories that don't get reported, and, you know, all the local journalists who no longer have jobs. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's a fascinating way that there's a kind of way that this is still a material history. I mean, it used to be that the newspaper was the entity that captured the revenue for generating the news. But what you get now is a situation where the device manufacturer is the one who's capturing the revenue from people reading the news. So, you know, Apple is selling a lot of, and Samsung, they're selling a lot of devices that people are using to access, you know, quote unquote newspapers. And so there's still a lot of money floating around in the media business. Like, you can still make a lot of money in that business, but newspapers just lost the ability to capture the revenue streams that they had captured so successfully in the 20th century.
I think that's a good place to leave the book. I would love to hear about what you're working on right now.
So I'm working on a book that extends some of these themes about thinking about the connections between media and nature. And there's a bit in that about papermaking and chemistry, in thinking about, like, in the early 20th century, how that some of these same advances that generated massive increases in crop yields for farmers was also helping to develop the technologies, develop the ways of making paper, both out of wood pulp and then out of all sorts of other materials that at the time were considered candidates for repatriating American manufacturing. There was a fascinating episode in the teens and 20s as the industry was shifting north, where there were a number of these entrepreneurs, and there were people in the United States Department of Agriculture who supported this, who thought that we might be able to make paper in this country out of corn. And so there were all these experiments going, and they ultimately never took off. But those experiments did bear fruit after World War II in the American South, where people, entrepreneurs and inventors were able to find ways of using Southern pine to manufacture newsprint, and to sort of exploit American forests in the interest of producing American newspapers in the U.S. South. And so there's some material in this new book about the ways in which people manipulated, looked at the landscape and looked at nature and saw things that they could use to communicate. There's also a history of broadcasting in there, and thinking about how when people were kind of developing conceptions of what radio was and how to regulate it, a lot of times what they were drawing from were conceptions that they had of landed property. Whether you would sell a parcel of land to a private developer, or whether you would lease that parcel of land to someone and allow them to develop it under license. And that was essentially what the Americans did with broadcasting. But a lot of the ways that people thought about it were drawn from nature. And that one of the founding principles of American broadcast regulation is this idea that broadcasters, when ostensibly, it's rarely actually enforced, but when they go to the federal licensing body and ask for their license to be renewed for another term, they have to demonstrate that they've operated in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, which was a standard that was extracted verbatim from public utility regulation in the decades before. And so I'm trying to kind of think about it. There's a way of kind of thinking about going back and kind of trying to reconstruct how policymakers looked at broadcasting as a public utility. And, you know, looking at how, and then thinking about what that might mean. You know, public utilities in many cases are given franchises to exploit nature, to exploit rivers, to develop hydroelectricity, to sell to municipalities and to corporations, provided that they operate in the public interest. And so I think we can think about the development of broadcasting policy in this country as having this kind of forgotten history that relates to the development of American utilities. And then finally, there's a bunch of stuff that I've been exploring that I didn't do enough of in Dead Tree Media that looks at the polluting effects of paper manufacturing and of newspaper publishing. I mean, anyone who's ever been near a paper mill town knows it because they've smelled it. I mean, it generates an awful sort of rotten egg smell. It generates a lot of wastewater, which is full of toxic chemicals, and it can generate a lot of solid waste, which is not good for the surrounding environment. So I've been looking at a number of ways that people have attempted to create and develop more, I mean, in contemporary terms, greener ways of manufacturing media, and thinking about how to you know, recycle both paper and, you know, more recently, these digital devices. I mean, there's the problem of e-waste has become, you know, really, I mean, it's become a huge problem in many municipalities. So the book, it's tentatively titled Communicating with Nature, but the basic idea is that it looks at how people in the industrial era looked at nature as something that they could manipulate in the interest of generating communications media.
Great. I really look forward to reading that whenever it comes out.
Thanks.
Michael, I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you very much for having me, Dexter. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Great. And I've been speaking with Michael Stamm, the author of Dead Tree Media, Manufacturing the Newspaper in 20th Century North America. And you've been listening to New Books in History.